14. Sold for the benefit of the creditors and heirs of the estate of Jesse Blutchford. Samuel Morris, Thomas Flint, executors.
"This here I must look at," said he to Tom, for want of somebody else to talk to.
"You see, I'm going to get up a prime gang to take down with you, Tom. It'll make it sociable and pleasant, like good company, will you know? We must drive right to Washington first and foremost, and then I'll clap you into jail while I does the business."
Tom received this agreeable intelligence quite meekly, simply wondering in his own heart how many of these doomed men had wives and children, and whether they would feel as he did about leaving them. It is to be confessed, too, that the naive, oft-hand information that he was to be thrown into jail by no means produced an agreeable impression on a poor fellow, who had always prided himself on a strictly honest and upright course of life. Yes, Tom, we must confess it was rather proud of his honesty, poor fellow, not having very much else to be proud of. If he had belonged to some of the higher walks of society, he perhaps would never have been reduced to such straits. However, the day wore on, and the evening saw Haley and Tom comfortably accommodated in Washington, the one in a tavern and the other in a jail. About 11 o'clock the next day, a mixed throng was gathered around the courthouse steps, smoking, chewing, spitting, swearing, and conversing, according to their respective tastes and turns, waiting for the auction to commence. The men and women to be sold sat in a group apart, talking in a low tone to each other. The woman, who had been advertised by the name of Hagar, was a regular African in feature and figure. She might have been 60, but was older than that by hard work and disease, was partially blind and somewhat crippled with rheumatism. By her side stood her only remaining son, Albert, a bright-looking little fellow of 14 years. The boy was the only survivor of a large family, who had been successively sold away from her to a southern market. The mother held on to him with both her shaking hands and eyed with intense trepidation every one who walked up to examine him.
"Don't be feared, Aunt Hagar," said the oldest of the men. "I spoke to Master Thomas about it, and he thought he might manage to sell you in a lot both together."
"Didn't need call me worn out yet," said she, lifting her shaking hands. "I can cook yet, and scrub, and scour. I'm worth a buying. If I do come cheap, tell him Dad, are you? Tell him," she added earnestly.
Haley here forced his way into the group, walked up to the old man, pulled his mouth open and looked in, felt of his teeth, made him stand and straighten himself, bend his back and perform various evolutions to show his muscles, and then passed on to the next, and put him through the same trial. Walking up last to the boy, he felt of his arms, straightened his hands, and looked at his fingers, and made him jump, to show his agility.
"He ain't going to be sold without me," said the old woman with passionate eagerness. "He and I goes in a lot together. I's real strong yet, massa, and can do heaps of work, heaps on it, massa."
"On plantation," said Haley, with a contemptuous glance. "Likely story."
And as if satisfied with his examination, he walked out and looked, and stood with his hands in his pocket, his cigar in his mouth, and his hat cocked on one side, ready for action.
"Well, think of him," said a man who had been following Haley's examination as if to make up his own mind from it.
"Why," said Haley, spitting, "I shall put in, I think, for the youngerly ones and the boy."
"They want to sell the boy and the old woman together," said the man.
"Find it a tight pull. Why, she's an old rack of bones, not worth her salt."
"You wouldn't, then?" said the man.
"Anybody'd be a fool, too, would. She's half blind, crooked with rheumatiz, and foolish to boot. Some buys up these year-old critters and sees there's a sight more wear in 'em than a body'd think," said the man reflectively.
"No go, Tall," said Haley. "Wouldn't take her for a present. Fact, I've seen now.
Well, 'tis kind of pity now not to buy her with her son. Her heart seems so sot on him. Suppose they fling her in cheap.
Them that's got money to spend that our way, it's all well enough. I shall bid off on that our boy for a plantation hand. Wouldn't be bothered with her no way. Not if they give it to me," said Haley.
"She'll take on despot," said the man.
"Naturally she will," said the trader coolly.
The conversation was here interrupted by a busy hum in the audience, and the auctioneer, a short, bustling, important fellow, elbowed his way into the crowd. The old woman drew in her breath and caught instinctively at her son.
"Keep close to your mammy, Albert, close. They'll put us together," she said.
"Oh, mammy, I'm feared they won't," said the boy.
"They must, child. I can't live no ways if they don't," said the old creature vehemently.
The stentorian tones of the auctioneer, calling out to clear the way, now announced that the sale was about to commence. A place was cleared, and the bidding began. The different men on the list were soon knocked off at prices which showed a pretty brisk demand in the market. Two of them fell to Haley.
"Now come, young'un," said the auctioneer, giving the boy a touch with his hammer. "Be up and show your springs now."
"Put us two up together.
Together. Do please, master," said the old woman, holding fast to her boy.
"Be off," said the man, gruffly pushing her hands away. "You come last. Now, darky, spring."
And with the word he pushed the boy toward the block, while a deep, heavy groan rose behind him. The boy paused and looked back, but there was no time to stay. And dashing the tears from his large, bright eyes, he was up in a moment. His fine figure, alert limbs, and bright face raised an instant competition, and half a dozen bids simultaneously met the ear of the auctioneer. Anxious, half-frightened, he looked from side to side as he heard the clatter of contending bids, now here, now there, till the hammer fell. Haley had got him. He was pushed from the block toward his new master, but stopped one moment and looked back, when his poor old mother, trembling in every limb, held out her shaking hands toward him. "Buy me two, massa, for dear Lord's sake, buy me. I shall die if you don't."
"You'll die if I do. That's the kink of it," said Haley. "No."
And he turned on his heel. The bidding for the poor old creature was summary. The man who had addressed Haley, and who seemed not destitute of compassion, bought her for a trifle, and the spectators began to disperse. The poor victims of the sale, who had been brought up in one place together for years, gathered round the despairing old mother, whose agony was pitiful to see. "Couldn't they leave me one? Massa always said I should have one." "He did," she repeated over and over in heartbroken tones. "Trust in the Lord, Aunt Hagar," said the oldest of the men sorrowfully. "What good will it do?" said she, sobbing passionately. "Mother, mother, don't, said the boy. "They say you's got a good master." "I don't care, I don't care. Oh, Albert, oh, my boy, you's my last baby. Lord, how can I—"
"Come, take her off, can't some of you," said Haley dryly. "Don't do no good for her to go on that away."
The old men of the company, partly by persuasion and partly by force, loosed the poor creature's last despairing hold, and as they led her off to her new master's wagon, strove to comfort her. "Now," said Haley, pushing his three purchases together, and producing a bundle of handcuffs, which he proceeded to put on their wrists, and fastening each handcuff to a long chain, he drove them before him to the jail. A few days saw Haley with his possessions safely deposited on one of the Ohio boats. It was the commencement of his gang, to be augmented as the boat moved on, by various other merchandise of the same kind, which he or his agent had stored for him in various points along shore. The La Belle Riviere, as brave and beautiful a boat as ever walked the waters of her namesake river, was floating gaily down the stream under a brilliant sky, the stripes and stars of Free America waving and fluttering overhead, the guards crowded with well-dressed ladies and gentlemen walking and enjoying the delightful day. All was full of life, buoyant and rejoicing. All but Haley's gang, who were stored with other freight on the lower deck, and who somehow did not seem to appreciate their various privileges as they sat in a knot, talking to each other in low tones.
"Boys," said Haley, coming up briskly, "I hope you keep up good heart and are cheerful. Now no sulks, you see. Keep stiff upper lip, boys. Do well by me, and I'll do well by you."
The boys addressed responded the invariably, "Yes, massa." For ages, the watchword of poor Africa. But it's to be owned, they did not look particularly cheerful. They had their various little prejudices in favor of wives, mothers, sisters, and children, seen for the last time. And though they that wasted them required of them mirth, it was not instantly forthcoming. "I've got a wife," spoke out the article, enumerated as John, aged 30, and he laid his chained hand on Tom's knee, "and she don't know a word about this poor girl."
"Where does she live?" said Tom.
"In a tavern, a piece down here," said John. "I wish now I could see her once more in this world," he added.
Poor John!
It was rather natural, and the tears that fell as he spoke came as naturally as if he had been a white man. Tom drew a long breath from a sore heart and tried, in his poor way, to comfort him. And overhead in the cabin sat fathers and mothers, husbands and wives, and merry dancing children moved around them, like so many little butterflies, and everything was going on quite easy and comfortable.
"Oh, mamma," said a boy who had just come up from below, "there's a negro trader on board, and he's brought four or five slaves down there."
"Poor creatures," said the mother, in a tone between grief and indignation.
"What's that?" said another lady.
"Some poor slaves below," said the mother.
"And they've got chains on," said the boy.
"What a shame to our country, that such sights are to be seen," said another lady.
"Oh, there's a great deal to be said on both sides of the subject," said a genteel woman who sat at her stateroom door sewing, while her little girl and boy were playing round her. "I've been south, and I must say I think the negroes are better off than they would be to be free."
"In some respects some of them are well off, I grant," said the lady to whose remark she had answered. "The most dreadful part of slavery, to my mind, is its outrages on the feelings and affections, the separating of families, for example." "That is a bad thing, certainly," said the other lady, holding up a baby's dress she had just completed and looking intently on its trimmings. "But then I fancy it don't occur often."
"Oh, it does," said the first lady eagerly. "I've lived many years in Kentucky and Virginia both, and I've seen enough to make anyone's heart sick. Suppose, ma'am, your two children, there, should be taken from you and sold."
"We can't reason from our feelings to those of this class of persons," said the other lady, sorting out some worsteds on her lap.
"Indeed, ma'am, you can know nothing of them, if you say so," answered the first lady warmly. "I was born and brought up among them. I know they do feel just as keenly, even more so, perhaps, as we do."
The lady said, "Indeed," yawned and looked out the cabin window, and finally repeated, for a finale, the remark with which she had begun. "After all, I think they are better off than they would be to be free." It's undoubtedly the intention of Providence that the African race should be servants, kept in a low condition, said a grave-looking gentleman in black, a clergyman, seated by the cabin door. "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be," the scripture says. Genesis 9:25. This is what Noah says when he wakes out of drunkenness and realizes that his youngest son, Ham, father of Canaan, has seen him naked.
"I say, stranger, is that what that text means?" said a tall man standing by.
"Undoubtedly.
It pleased Providence for some inscrutable reason to doom the race to bondage, ages ago, and we must not set up our opinion against that." "Well, then, we'll all go ahead and buy up niggers," said the man. "If that's the way of Providence, won't we, squire?" said he, turning to Haley, who had been standing with his hands in his pockets by the stove and intently listening to the conversation.
"Yes," continued the tall man, "we must all be resigned to the decrees of Providence. Niggers must be sold and trucked around and kept under. It's what they's made for."
"'Pears like that's your view's quite refreshing, ain't it, stranger?" said he to Haley.
"I never thought on it," said Haley. "I couldn't have said as much myself. I ain't no learning. I took up the trade just to make a living. If 'tain't right, I calculate it depend on it in time, you know."
"And now you'll save yourself the trouble, won't you?" said the tall man. "See what it says now, to know scripture. If you'd only studied your Bible, like this year, good man, he might have knowed it before and saved you a heap of trouble. You could just have said, 'Cussed be. What's his name?' And that'd all have come right."
And the stranger, who was no other than the honest drover, whom we introduced to our readers in the Kentucky Tavern, sat down and began smoking, with a curious smile on his long, dry face. A tall, slender young man with a face expressive of great feeling and intelligence here broke in, and repeated the words, "All thing whatsoever ye would that men should do unto you, do ye so unto them," I suppose, he added. "That is scripture, as much as cursed be Canaan."
"Well, it seems quite as plain a text, stranger," said John the drover, "to poor fellows like us now," and John smoked on like a volcano. The young man paused, looked as if he was going to say more, when suddenly the boat stopped, and the company made the usual steamboat rush to see where they were landing. "Both them are chaps parsons," said John to one of the men, as they were going out. The man nodded. As the boat stopped, a black woman came running wildly up the plank, darted into the crowd, flew up to where the slave gang sat, and threw her arms round that unfortunate piece of merchandise before enumerate John, age 30, and with sobs and tears bemoaned him as her husband. But what needs tell the story told too oft, every day told, of heartstrings rent and broken, the weak broken and torn for the profit and convenience of the strong? It needs not be told, every day is telling it too, in the ear of one who is not deaf, though he be long silent. The young man who had spoken for the cause of humanity and God before stood with folded arms looking on this scene. He turned, and Haley was standing at his side. "My friend," he said, speaking with thick utterance, how dare you carry on a trade like this? Look at those poor creatures. Here I am rejoicing in my heart that I am going home to my wife and child, and the same bell which is a signal to carry me onward towards them will part this poor man and his wife forever. Depend on it, God will bring you into judgment for this." The trader turned away in silence.
"I say now," said the drover, touching his elbow, "there's differences in parsons, ain't there? Cussed be Canaan. Don't seem to go down with this son, does it?"
Haley gave an uneasy growl.
"And that ar ain't the worst on it," said John. "Maybe it won't go down with the Lord neither when you come to settle with him one of these days, as all on us must, I reckon."
Haley walked reflectively to the other end of the boat. "If I make pretty handsomely on one or two next gangs," he thought, "I reckon I'll stop off this year. It's really getting dangerous." And he took out his pocketbook and began adding over his accounts, a process which many gentlemen besides Mr. Haley have found a specific for an uneasy conscience. The boat swept proudly away from the shore, and all went on merrily as before.
Men talked and loafed and read and smoked. Women sewed and children played, and the boat passed on her way. One day, when she lay for a while at a small town in Kentucky, Haley went up into the place on a little matter of business. Tom, whose fetters did not prevent his taking a moderate circuit, had drawn near the side of the boat and stood listlessly gazing over the railing. After a time he saw the trader returning with an alert step in company with a colored woman, bearing in her arms a young child. She was dressed quite respectably, and a colored man followed her, bringing along a small trunk. The woman came cheerfully onward, talking, as she came, with the man who bore her trunk, and so passed up the plank into the boat. The bell rung, the steamer whizzed, the engine groaned and coughed, and away swept the boat down the river. The woman walked forward among the boxes and bales of the lower deck, and sitting down, busied herself with chirruping to her baby. Haley made a turn or two about the boat, and then coming up, seated himself near her, and began saying something to her in an indifferent undertone. Tom soon noticed a heavy cloud passing over the woman's brow, and that she answered rapidly and with great vehemence. "I don't believe it! I won't believe it!" he heard her say. "You're just a-foolin' with me." "If you won't believe it, look here," said the man, drawing out a paper. "This here's the bill of sale, and there's your master's name on it. And I paid down good solid cash for her, too. I can tell you. So now!" "I don't believe master would cheat me so. It can't be true," said the woman with increasing agitation. "You can ask any of these men here that can read writin'. Here," he said to a man that was passing by, "just read this here, won't you? This here gal won't believe me when I tell her what 'tis." "Why, it's a bill of sale, signed by John Fosdick," said the man. "Making over to you. The girl Lucy and her child. It's all straight enough for aught I see." The woman's passionate exclamations collected a crowd around her, and the trader briefly explained to them the cause of the agitation. "He told me that I was going down to Louisville to hire out as a cook to the same tavern where my husband works. That's what master told me. His own self, and I can't believe he'd lied to me," said the woman. "But he has sold you, my poor woman, there's no doubt about it," said a good-natured-looking man, who has been examining the papers. "He has done it, and no mistake." "Then it's no count talking," said the woman, suddenly growing quite calm and clasping her child tighter in her arms. She sat down on her box, turned her back round, and gazed listlessly into the river. "Going to take it easy after all," said the trader. "Gal's got grit, I see." The woman looked calm as the boat went on, and a beautiful soft summer breeze passed like a compassionate spirit over her head. The gentle breeze that never inquires whether the brow is dusky or fair, that it fans. And she saw sunshine sparkling on the water in golden ripples and heard gay voices full of ease and pleasure, talking around her, everywhere. But her heart lay as if a great stone had fallen on it. Her baby raised himself up against her, and stroked her cheeks with his little hands, and springing up and down, crowing and chatting, seemed determined to arouse her. She strained him suddenly and tightly in her arms, and slowly one tear after another fell on his wondering, unconscious face. And gradually she seemed, and little by little, to grow calmer, and busied herself with tending and nursing him. The child, a boy of 10 months, was uncommonly large and strong of his age, and very vigorous in his limbs. Never for a moment still, he kept his mother constantly busy in holding him and guarding his springing activity. "That's a fine chap," said a man, suddenly stopping opposite to him, with his hands in his pockets. "How old is he?"
10 months and a half, said the mother.
The man whistled to the boy, and offered him part of a stick of candy, which he eagerly grabbed at, and very soon had it in a baby's general depository, to wit, his mouth. "Rum fellow," said the man, "knows what's what," and he whistled and walked on. When he had got to the other side of the boat, he came across Haley, who was smoking on top of a pile of boxes. The stranger produced a match and lighted a cigar, saying as he did so, "Decentish kind of wench you got round there, stranger." "Why, I reckon she is. Tolerable fair," said Haley, blowing the smoke out of his mouth. "Taking her down south," said the man. Haley nodded and smoked on. "Plantation hand?" said the man. "Well," said Haley, "I'm filling out an order for a plantation, and I think I shall put her in. They tell me she was a good cook, and they can use her for that. Or set her at the cotton picking. She's got the right fingers for that. I looked at 'em. Sell well, either way." And Haley resumed his cigar. "They won't want the young'un on the plantation," said the man. "I shall sell him first chance I find," said Haley, lighting another cigar. "Suppose you be selling him tall but cheap," said the stranger. "Mounting the pile of boxes and sitting down comfortably?" "Don't know about that," said Haley. "He's a pretty smart young'un, straight, fat, strong, flesh as hard as a brick." "Very true, but then there's the bother and expense of raising." "Nonsense," said Haley. "He's raised as easy as any kind of critter there is going. They ain't a bit more trouble than pups. This here chap will be running all around in a month." "I've got a good place for raising, and I thought of taking in a little more stock," said the man. "One cook lost a young'un last week, got drowned in a wash-tub while she was a-hanging out the clothes, and I reckon it would be well enough to set her to raising this year." Haley and the stranger smoked a while in silence, neither seeming willing to broach the test question of the interview. At last the man resumed. "You wouldn't think of wanting more than $10 for that, our chap, seeing you must get him off your hand anyhow." Haley shook his head and spit impressively. "That won't do no ways," he said, and began his smoking again. "Well, stranger, what will you take?" "Well, now," said Haley, "I could raise that our chap myself or get him raised. He's uncommon likely and healthy, and he'd fetch $100 6 months hence, and in a year or two he'd bring $200 if I had him in the right spot. I shan't take a cent less nor 50 for him now." "Ah, stranger, that's ridiculous altogether," said the man. "Fact," said Haley, with a decisive nod of his head. "I'll give 30 for him," said the stranger, "but not a cent more." "Now I'll tell you what I will do," said Haley, spitting again with renewed decision. "I'll split the difference, and say 45, and that's the most I will do." "Well, agreed," said the man, after an interval. "Done," said Haley. "Where do you land?" "At Louisville," said the man. "Louisville," said Haley, "very fair. We get there about dusk. Chap will be asleep, all fair. Get him off quietly, and no screaming. Happens beautiful. I like to do everything quietly. I hates all kind of agitation and fluster." And so, after a transfer of certain bills had passed from the man's pocketbook to the trader's, he resumed his cigar. It was a bright, tranquil evening when the boat stopped at the wharf at Louisville. The woman had been sitting with her baby in her arms, now wrapped in a heavy sleep. When she heard the name of the place called out, she hastily laid the child down in a little cradle, formed by the hollow among the boxes, first carefully spreading under it her cloak. And then she sprung to the side of the boat in hopes that, among the various hotel waiters who thronged the wharf, she might see her husband. In this hope she pressed forward to the front rails, and stretching far over them strained her eyes intently on the moving heads on the shore. And the crowd pressed in between her and the child. "Now's your time," said Haley, taking the sleeping child up and handing him to the stranger. "Don't wake him up and set him to crying now. It would make a devil of a fuss with the gal." The man took the bundle carefully and was soon lost in the crowd that went up the wharf. When the boat, creaking and groaning and puffing, had loosed from the wharf and was beginning slowly to strain herself along, the woman returned to her old seat. The trader was sitting there. The child was gone.
What?
She began in bewildered surprise. "Lucy," said the trader, "your child's gone. You may as well know it, first as last. You see, I knowed you couldn't take him down south, and I got a chance to sell him to a first-rate family that'll raise him better than you can." The trader had arrived at that stage of Christian and political perfection, which has been recommended by some preachers and politicians of the North lately, in which he had completely overcome every humane weakness and prejudice. His heart was exactly where yours, sir, and mine could be brought, with proper effort and cultivation. The wild look of anguish and utter despair that the woman cast on him might have disturbed one less practiced, but he was used to it. He had seen that same look hundreds of times. "You can get used to such things, too, my friend, and it is the great object of recent efforts to make our whole northern community used to them, for the glory of the Union." So the trader only regarded the mortal anguish which he saw working in those dark features, those clenched hands, and suffocating breathings, as necessary incidents of the trade, and merely calculated whether she was going to scream and get up a commotion on the boat, for, like other supporters of our peculiar institution, he decidedly disliked agitation. But the woman did not scream. The shot had passed too straight and direct through the heart, for cry or tear. Dizzily she sat down. Her slack hands fell lifeless by her side. Her eyes looked straight forward, but she saw nothing. All the noise and hum of the boat, the groaning of the machinery, mingled dreamily to her bewildered ear, and the poor, dumb-stricken heart had neither cry nor tear to show for its utter misery. She was quite calm. The trader, who, considering his advantages, was almost as humane as some of our politicians, seemed to feel called on to administer such consolation as the case admitted of. "I know this year comes kind of hard at first, Lucy," said he. "But such a smart, sensible gal as you are won't give way to it. You see, it's necessary. Can't be helped."
"Oh, don't, massa, don't," said the woman, with a voice like one that is smothering.
"You're a smart wench, Lucy," he persisted. "I mean to do well by you, and get you a nice place down river, and you'll soon get another husband, such a likely gal as you.
Oh, massa, if you only won't talk to me now," said the woman, in a voice of such quick and living anguish that the trader felt that there was something at present in the case beyond his style of operation.
He got up, and the woman turned away and buried her head in her cloak. The trader walked up and down for a time, and occasionally stopped and looked at her. "Takes it hard, rather," he soliloquized. "Quiet, though. Let her sweat a while, and she'll come right by and by." Tom had watched the whole transaction from first to last, and had a perfect understanding of its results. To him it looked like something unutterably horrible and cruel, because poor, ignorant black soul, he had not learned to generalize and to take enlarged views. If he had only been instructed by certain ministers of Christianity, he might have thought better of it and seen in it an everyday incident of a lawful trade, a trade which is the vital support of an institution, which an American divine tells us has no evils but such as are inseparable from any other relations in social and domestic life. But Tom, as we see, being a poor, ignorant fellow, whose reading had been confined entirely to the New Testament, could not comfort and solace himself with views like these. His very soul bled within him for what seemed to him the wrongs of the poor suffering thing that lay like a crushed reed on the boxes. The feeling, living, bleeding, yet immortal thing, which American state law coolly classes with the bundles and bales and boxes among which she is lying. Tom drew near and tried to say something, but she only groaned. Honestly, and with tears running down his own cheeks, he spoke of a heart of love in the skies, of a pitying Jesus, and an eternal home. But the ear was deaf with anguish, and the palsied heart could not feel. Night came on, night calm, unmoved, and glorious, shining down with her innumerable and solemn angel eyes, twinkling, beautiful, but silent. There was no speech, nor language, no pitying voice or helping hand from that distant sky. One after another the voices of business or pleasure died away. All on the boat were sleeping, and the ripples of the prow were plainly heard. Tom stretched himself out on a box, and there, as he lay, he heard ever and anon a smothered sob or cry from the prostrate creature. Oh, what shall I do? Oh, Lord, oh, good Lord, do help me. And so ever and anon until the murmur died away in silence. At midnight Tom waked with a sudden start. Something black passed quickly by him to the side of the boat, and he heard a splash in the water. No one else saw or heard anything. He raised his head. The woman's place was vacant. He got up and sought about him in vain. Poor bleeding heart was still at last. And the river rippled and dimpled just as brightly as if it had not closed above it. Patience, patience, ye whose hearts swell indignant at wrongs like these. Not one throb of anguish, not one tear of the oppressed, is forgotten by the man of sorrows, the Lord of glory. In his patient, generous bosom he bears the anguish of a world. Bear thou like him in patience and labor in love, for sure as he is God, the year of his redeemed shall come. The trader waked up bright and early and came out to see to his livestock. It was now his turn to look about in perplexity. "Where alive is that gal?" he said to Tom. Tom, who had learned the wisdom of keeping counsel, did not feel called upon to state his observations and suspicions, but said he did not know. "She surely wouldn't have got off in the night at any of the landings, for I was awake and on the lookout whenever the boat stopped. I never trust these here things to other folks." This speech was addressed to Tom quite confidentially, as if it was something that would be specially interesting to him. Tom made no answer. The trader searched the boat from stem to stern, among boxes, bales, and barrels, around the machinery, by the chimneys, in vain. "Now, I say, Tom, be fair about this year," he said, when after a fruitless search he came where Tom was standing. "You know something about it now. Don't tell me I know you do. I saw the gal stretched out here about 10 o'clock, and again at 12, and again between 1 and 2, and then at 4 she was gone. And you was a-sleeping right there all the time. Now you know something. You can't help it." "Well, massa," said Tom, "towards morning something brushed by me, and I kind of half woke, and then I heard a great splash, and then I clear woke up, and the gal was gone. That's all I know on't." The trader was not shocked nor amazed, because, as we said before, he was used to a great many things that you are not used to. Even the awful presence of death struck no solemn chill upon him. He had seen death many times, met him in the way of trade, and got acquainted with him, and he only thought of him as a hard customer that embarrassed his property operations very unfairly, and so he only swore that the gal was a baggage, and that he was devilish unlucky, and that, if things went on in this way, he should not make a cent on the trip. In short, he seemed to consider himself an ill-used man, decidedly. But there was no help for it, as the woman had escaped into a state which never will give up a fugitive, not even at the demand of the whole glorious Union. The trader, therefore, sat discontentedly down with his little account-book, and put down the missing body and soul under the head of losses. "He's a shocking creature, isn't he, this trader? So unfeeling. It's dreadful, really. Oh, but nobody thinks anything of these traitors. They are universally despised, never received into any decent society. But who, sir, makes the traitor? Who is most to blame? The enlightened, cultivated, intelligent man who supports the system of which the traitor is the inevitable result, or the poor traitor himself? You make the public statement that calls for his trade, that debauches and depraves him, till he feels no shame in it. And in what are you better than he? Are you educated and he ignorant? You high and he low, you refined and he coarse, you talented and he simple? In the day of a future judgment, these very considerations may make it more tolerable for him than for you. In conclusion, these little incidents of lawful trade, we must beg the world not to think that American legislators are entirely destitute of humanity, as might perhaps be unfairly inferred from the great efforts made in our national body to protect and perpetuate this species of traffic. Who does not know how our great men are outdoing themselves in declaiming against the foreign slave trade? There are a perfect host of Clarksons and Wilberforces risen up among us on that subject, most edifying to hear and behold. Trading Negroes from Africa, dear reader, is so horrid. It is not to be thought of. But trading them from Kentucky? That's quite another thing. Chapter 13. The Quaker Settlement. A quiet scene now rises before us. A large, roomy, neatly painted kitchen. Its yellow floor glossy and smooth, and without a particle of dust. A neat, well-blacked cooking stove. Rows of shining tin, suggestive of unmentionable good things to the appetite. Glossy green wood chairs, old and firm. A small flag-bottomed rocking chair with a patchwork cushion in it. Neatly contrived out of small pieces of different colored woolen goods. And a larger-sized one, motherly and old, whose wide arms breathed hospitable invitation, seconded, by the solicitation of its feather cushions, a real comfortable persuasive old chair, and worth in the way of honest, homely enjoyment, a dozen of your plush or brochetel drawing-room gentry, and in the chair, gently swaying back and forward, her eyes bent on some fine sewing, sat our fine, old friend, Eliza. Yes, there she is, paler and thinner than in her Kentucky home, with a world of quiet sorrow lying under the shadow of her long eyelashes, and marking the outline of her gentle mouth. It was plain to see how old and firm the girlish heart was grown under the discipline of heavy sorrow, and when anon her large dark eyes was raised to follow the gambols of her little Harry, who was sporting like some tropical butterfly, hither and thither over the floor, she showed a depth of firmness and steady resolve that was never there in her earlier and happier days. By her side sat a woman with a bright tin pan in her lap, into which she was carefully sorting some dried peaches. She might be 55 or 60, but hers was one of those faces that time seems to touch only to brighten and adorn. The snowy lisse crepe cap, made after the straight Quaker pattern, the plain white muslin handkerchief lying in placid folds across her bosom, the drab shawl and dress showed at once the community to which she belonged. Her face was round and rosy, with a healthful downy softness, suggestive of a ripe peach. Her hair, partially silvered by age, was parted smoothly back from a high, placid forehead, on which time had written no inscription, except peace on earth, goodwill to men. And beneath shone a large pair of clear, honest, loving brown eyes. You only needed to look straight into them to feel that you saw to the bottom of a heart as good and true as ever throbbed in woman's bosom. So much has been said and sung of beautiful young girls. Why don't somebody wake up to the beauty of old women? If any want to get up an inspiration under this head, we refer them to our good friend Rachel Halliday, just as she sits there in her little rocking chair. It had a turn for quacking and squeaking, that chair had, either from having taken cold in early life, or from some asthmatic affection, or perhaps from nervous derangement, but as she gently swung backward and forward, the chair kept up a kind of subdued creechy-crotchy that would have been intolerable in any other chair. But old Simon Halliday often declared it was as good as any music to him, and the children all avowed that they wouldn't miss of hearing mother's chair for anything in the world, for why? For 20 years or more, nothing but loving words and gentle moralities and motherly loving-kindness had come from that chair. Headaches and heartaches innumerable had been cured there, difficulties spiritual and temporal solved there, all by one good, loving woman. God bless her. And so these still thinks of going to Canada, Eliza? she said as she was quietly looking over her peaches.
"Yes, ma'am," said Eliza firmly. "I must go onward. I dare not stop." "And what'll he do when he gets there?"
"They must think about that, my daughter."
"My daughter" came naturally from the lips of Rachel Halliday, for hers was just the face and form that made mother seem the most natural word in the world. Eliza's hands trembled, and some tears fell on her fine work, but she answered firmly,
"I shall do anything I can find. I hope I can find something."
"Thee knows thee can stay here as long as thee pleases," said Rachel.
"Oh, thank you," said Eliza, "but—"
she pointed to Harry. "I can't sleep nights. I can't rest. Last night I dreamed I saw that man coming into the yard," she said, shuddering.
"Poor child," said Rachel, wiping her eyes. "But thee mustn't feel so. The Lord hath ordered it so that never hath a fugitive been stolen from our village. I trust thine will not be the first."
The door here opened, and a little short, round, pin-cushiony woman stood at the door with a cheery, blooming face, like a ripe apple. She was dressed like Rachel, in sober gray, with the muslin folded neatly across her round, plump little chest.
"Ruth Steadman," said Rachel, coming joyfully forward. "How is thee, Ruth?" she said heartily, taking both her hands.
"Nicely," said Ruth, taking off her little drab bonnet, and dusting it with her handkerchief, displaying as she did so a round little head, on which the Quaker cap sat with a sort of jaunty air, despite all the stroking and patting of the small fat hands, which were busily applied to arranging it. Certain stray locks of decidedly curly hair, too, had escaped here and there, and had to be coaxed and cajoled into their place again. And then the newcomer, who might have been 25, turned from the small looking-glass, before which she had been making these arrangements, and looked well pleased, as most people who looked at her might have been, for she was decidedly a wholesome, whole-hearted, chirruping little woman, as ever gladdened man's heart withal.
"Ruth, this friend is Eliza Harris, and this is the little boy I told thee of."
"I am glad to see thee, Eliza, very," said Ruth, shaking hands, as if Eliza were an old friend she had long been expecting. "And this is thy dear boy."
"I brought a cake for him," she said, holding out a little heart to the boy, who came up, gazing through his curls, and accepted it shyly.
"Where's thy baby, Ruth?" said Rachel.
"Oh, he's coming. But thy Mary caught him as I came in and ran off with him to the barn to show him to the children."
At this moment the door opened, and Mary, an honest, rosy-looking girl, with large brown eyes, like her mother's, came in with the baby.
"Aha!" said Rachel, coming up and taking the great, white, fat fellow in her arms. "How good he looks, and how he does grow!"
"To be sure he does," said little bustling Ruth, as she took the child and began taking off a little blue silk hood and various layers and wrappers of outer garments, and having given a twitch here and a pull there, and variously adjusted and arranged him and kissed him heartily, she set him on the floor to collect his thoughts.
Baby seemed quite used to this mode of proceeding, for he put his thumb in his mouth, as if it were quite a thing, of course, and seemed soon absorbed in his own reflections, while the mother seated herself, and taking out a long stocking of mixed blue and white yarn, began to knit with briskness.
"Mary, thee'd better fill the kettle, hadn't thee?" gently suggested the mother.
Mary took the kettle to the well, and soon reappearing, placed it over the stove, where it was soon purring and steaming, a sort of censer of hospitality and good cheer. The peaches, moreover, in obedience to a few gentle whispers from Rachel, were soon deposited by the same hand in a stewpan over the fire. Rachel now took down a snowy moulding-board, and tying on an apron, proceeded quietly to making up some biscuits, first saying to Mary, "Mary, hadn't thee better tell John to get a chicken ready?" And Mary disappeared accordingly. "And how is Abigail Peters?" said Rachel, as she went on with her biscuits.
"Oh, she's better," said Ruth.
"I was in this morning, made the bed, tidied up the house. Leah Hills went in this afternoon and baked bread and pies enough to last some days, and I engaged to go back to get her up this evening. I will go in tomorrow and do any cleaning there may be and look over the mending," said Rachel.
"Ah, that is well," said Ruth. "I've heard," she added, "that Hannah Stanwood is sick. John was up there last night. I must go there tomorrow."
"John can come in here to his meals, if thee needs to stay all day," suggested Rachel.
"Thank thee, Rachel.
We'll see, tomorrow. But here comes Simon." Simon Halliday, a tall, straight, muscular man in drab coat and pantaloons and broad-brimmed hat, now entered.
"How is thee, Ruth?" he said warmly, as he spread his broad, open hand for her little fat palm.
"And how is John?"
"Oh, John is well, and all the rest of our folks," said Ruth cheerily.
"Any news, father?" said Rachel, as she was putting her biscuits into the oven.
"Peter Stebbins told me that they should be along tonight with friends," said Simon significantly, as he was washing his hands at a neat sink in a little back porch.
"Indeed," said Rachel, looking thoughtfully and glancing at Eliza.
Did thee say thy name was Harris? Said Simon to Eliza as he re-entered. Rachel glanced quickly at her husband as Eliza tremulously answered, Yes. Her fears, ever uppermost, suggesting that possibly there might be advertisements out for her. Mother, said Simon, standing in the porch and calling Rachel out. What does thee want, father? Said Rachel, rubbing her flowery hands as she went into the porch. This child's husband is in the settlement and will be here tonight, said Simon. Now thee doesn't say that, father, said Rachel, all her face radiant with joy. It's really true. Peter was down yesterday with the wagon to the other stand, and there he found an old woman and two men, and one said his name was George Harris. And from what he told of his history, I am certain who he is. He's a bright, likely fellow, too. Shall we tell her now, said Simon? Let's tell Ruth, said Rachel. Here. Ruth, come here. Ruth laid down her knitting work and was in the back porch in a moment. Ruth, what does thee think? Said Rachel. Father says Eliza's husband is in the last company and will be here tonight. A burst of joy from the little Quakeress interrupted the speech. She gave such a bound from the floor as she clapped her little hands that two stray curls fell from under her Quaker cap and lay brightly on her white neckerchief. Hush thee, dear, said Rachel gently. Hush, Ruth. Tell us, shall we tell her now? Now, to be sure, this very minute. Why now? Suppose 'twas my John, how should I feel? Do tell her, right off. Thee uses thyself only to learn how to love thy neighbor, Ruth, said Simon, looking with a beaming face on Ruth. To be sure, isn't it what we are made for? If I didn't love John and the baby, I should not know how to feel for her. Come, now do tell her, do. And she laid her hands persuasively on Rachel's arm. Take her into thy bedroom there, and let me fry the chicken while thee does it. Rachel came out into the kitchen where Eliza was sewing, and opening the door of a small bedroom said gently, Come in here with me, my daughter. I have news to tell thee. The blood flushed in Eliza's pale face. She rose, trembling with nervous anxiety, and looked towards her boy. No, no, said little Ruth, darting up and seizing her hands. Never thee fear. It's good news, Eliza. Go in, go in. And she gently pushed her to the door, which closed after her, and then turning round, she caught little Harry in her arms and began kissing him. They'll see thy father, little one. Does thee know it? Thy father is coming, she said over and over again, as the boy looked wonderingly at her. Meanwhile, within the door, another scene was going on. Rachel Halliday drew Eliza toward her and said, The Lord hath had mercy on thee, daughter. Thy husband hath escaped from the house of bondage. The blood flushed to Eliza's cheek in a sudden glow and went back to her heart with as sudden a rush. She sat down pale and faint. Have courage, child, said Rachel, laying her hand on her head. He is among friends who will bring him here tonight. Tonight! Eliza repeated, tonight! The words lost all meaning to her. Her head was dreamy and confused. All was amiss for a moment. When she awoke, she found herself snugly tucked up on the bed, with a blanket over her, and little Ruth rubbing her hands with camphor. She opened her eyes in a state of dreamy, delicious languor, such as one who has long been bearing a heavy load, and now feels it gone and would rest. The tension of the nerves, which had never ceased a moment since the first hour of her flight, had given way, and a strange feeling of security and rest came over her, and as she lay with her large dark eyes open, she followed, as in a quiet dream, the motions of those about her. She saw the door open into the other room, saw the supper table with its snowy cloth, heard the dreamy murmur of the singing tea kettle, saw Ruth tripping backward and forward with plates of cake and saucers of preserves, and ever and anon stopping to put a cake into Harry's hand, or pat his head, or twine his long curls round her snowy fingers. She saw the ample motherly form of Rachel, as she ever and anon came to the bedside, and smoothed and arranged something about the bedclothes and gave a tuck here and there, by way of expressing her goodwill, and was conscious of a kind of sunshine beaming down upon her from her large, clear brown eyes. She saw Ruth's husband come in, saw her fly up to him, and commence whispering very earnestly, ever and anon, with impressive gesture, pointing her little finger toward the room. She saw her with the baby in her arms, sitting down to tea. She saw them all at table, and little Harry in a high chair, under the shadow of Rachel's ample wing. There were low murmurs of talk, gentle tinkling of teaspoons, and musical clatter of cups and saucers, and all mingled in a delightful dream of rest. And Eliza slept, as she had not slept before, since the fearful midnight hour when she had taken her child and fled through the frosty starlight. She dreamed of a beautiful country, a land, it seemed to her, of rest, green shores, pleasant islands, and beautifully glittering water, and there in a house which kind voices told her was a home, she saw her boy playing free and happy child. She heard her husband's footsteps, she felt him coming nearer, his arms were round her, his tears falling on her face, and she woke. It was no dream.
The daylight had long faded. Her child lay calmly sleeping by her side. A candle was burning dimly on the stand, and her husband was sobbing by her pillow. The next morning was a cheerful one at the Quaker house. Mother was up betimes and surrounded by busy girls and boys, whom we had scarce time to introduce to our readers yesterday, and who all moved obediently to Rachel's gentle, "Thee had better," or more gentle, "Hadn't thee better?" In the work of getting breakfast, for a breakfast in the luxurious valleys of Indiana is a thing complicated and multiform, and like picking up the rose leaves and trimming the bushes in paradise, asking other hands than those of the original mother. While therefore John ran to the spring for fresh water, and Simon the second sifted meal for corn cakes, and Mary ground coffee, Rachel moved gently and quietly about, making biscuits, cutting up chicken, and diffusing a sort of sunny radiance over the whole proceeding generally. If there was any danger of a friction or collision from the ill-regulated zeal of so many young operators, her gentle, "Come, come," or "I wouldn't, now," was quite sufficient to allay the difficulty. Bards have written of the cestus of Venus that turned the heads of all the world in successive generations. We had rather, for our part, have the cestus of Rachel Halliday that kept heads from being turned and made everything go on harmoniously. We think it is more suited to our modern days, decidedly. While all other preparations were going on, Simon the Elder stood in his shirt sleeves before a little looking-glass in the corner, engaged in the anti-patriarchal operation of shaving. Everything went on so sociably, so quietly, so harmoniously. In the great kitchen, it seemed so pleasant to everyone to do just what they were doing. There was such an atmosphere of mutual confidence and good fellowship everywhere. Even the knives and forks had a social clatter as they went on to the table, and the chicken and ham had a cheerful and joyous fizzle in the pan, as if they rather enjoyed being cooked than otherwise. And when George and Eliza and little Harry came out, they met such a hearty, rejoicing welcome. No wonder it seemed to them like a dream. At last they were all seated at breakfast while Mary stood at the stove baking griddle cakes, which, as they gained the true exact golden-brown tint of perfection, were transferred quite handily to the table. Rachel never looked so truly and benignly happy as at the head of her table. There was so much motherliness and full-heartedness, even in the way she passed a plate of cakes or poured a cup of coffee, that it seemed to put a spirit into the food and drink she offered. It was the first time that ever George had sat down on equal terms at any white man's table, and he sat down at first with some constraint and awkwardness. But they all exhaled and went off like fog, in the genial morning rays of this simple, overflowing kindness. This indeed was a home. Home. A word that George had never yet known a meaning for, and a belief in God and trust in his providence began to encircle his heart. As with a golden cloud of protection and confidence, dark, misanthropic, pining, atheistic doubts and fierce despair melted away before the light of a living gospel, breathed in living faces, preached by a thousand unconscious acts of love and goodwill, which, like the cup of cold water given in the name of a disciple, shall never lose their reward. "Father, what if thee should get found out again?" said Simon second, as he buttered his cake. "I should pay my fine," said Simon quietly. "But what if they put thee in prison?" "Couldn't thee and mother manage the farm?" said Simon, smiling. "Mother can do almost everything," said the boy. "But isn't it a shame to make such laws?" "Thee mustn't speak evil of thy ruler, Simon," said his father gravely. "The Lord only gives us our worldly goods, that we may do justice and mercy. If our rulers require a price for us for it, we must deliver it up." "Well, I hate those old slaveholders," said the boy, who felt as unchristian as became any modern reformer. "I'm surprised at thee, son," said Simon. "Thy mother never taught thee so. I would do even the same for the slaveholder as for the slave, if the Lord brought him to my door in affliction." Simon second blushed scarlet, but his mother only smiled and said, "Simon is my good boy. He will grow older, by and by, and then he will be like his father." "I hope, my good sir, that you are not exposed to any difficulty on our account," said George anxiously. "Fear nothing, George, for therefore are we sent into the world. If we would not meet trouble for a good cause, we were not worthy of our name." "But for me," said George, "I could not bear it." "Fear not, then, friend George. It is not for thee, but for God and man we do it," said Simon. "And now thou must lie by quietly this day, and tonight at 10 o'clock, Phineas Fletcher will carry thee onward to the next stand, thee and the rest of thy company. The pursuers are hard after thee. We must not delay." "If that is the case, why wait till evening?" said George. "Thou art safe here by daylight, for everyone in the settlement is a friend, and all are watching. It has been found safer to travel by night."
Chapter 14 Evangeline. A young star which shone o'er life, too sweet an image for such glass, a lovely being scarcely formed or moulded, a rose with all its sweetest leaves yet folded. The Mississippi. How, as by an enchanted wand, have its scenes been changed, since Chateaubriand wrote his prose poetic description of it as a river of mighty unbroken solitudes, rolling amid undreamed wonders of vegetable and animal existence. But as in an hour this river of dreams and wild romance has emerged to a reality scarcely less visionary and splendid, what other river of the world bears on its bosom to the ocean the wealth and enterprise of such another country? A country whose products embrace all between the tropics and the poles, those turbid waters hurrying, foaming, tearing along, an apt resemblance of that headlong tide of business which is poured along its wave by a race more vehement and energetic than any the old world ever saw. Ah, would that they did not also bear along a more fearful freight, the tears of the oppressed, the sighs of the helpless, the bitter prayers of poor, ignorant hearts to an unknown God, unknown, unseen, and silent. But who will yet come out of his place to save all the poor of the earth? The slanting light of the setting sun quivers on the sea-like expanse of the river, the shivery canes and the tall, dark cypress hung with wreaths of dark funereal moss glow in the golden ray, as the heavily laden steamboat marches onward. Piled with cotton bales from many a plantation, up over deck and sides till she seems in the distance a square, massive block of gray, she moves heavily onward to the nearing mart. We must look some time among its crowded decks before we shall find again our humble friend, Tom. High on the upper deck, in a little nook among the everywhere predominant cotton bales, at last we may find him. Partly from confidence inspired by Mr. Shelby's representations, and partly from the remarkably inoffensive and quiet character of the man, Tom had insensibly won his way far into the confidence even of such a man as Haley. At first he had watched him narrowly through the day, and never allowed him to sleep at night unfettered. But the uncomplaining patience and apparent contentment of Tom's manner led him gradually to discontinue these restraints, and for some time Tom had enjoyed a sort of parole of honor, being permitted to come and go freely where he pleased on the boat. Ever quiet and obliging, and more than ready to lend a hand in every emergency which occurred among the workmen below, he had won the good opinion of all the hands and spent many hours in helping them, with as hearty a goodwill as ever he worked on a Kentucky farm. When there seemed to be nothing for him to do, he would climb to a nook among the cotton bales of the upper deck and busy himself in studying over his Bible, and it was there we see him now. For 100 or more miles above New Orleans, the river is higher than the surrounding country and rolls its tremendous volume between massive levees 20 feet in height. The traveler from the deck of the steamer, as from some floating castle top, overlooks the whole country for miles and miles around. Tom, therefore, had spread out full before him in plantation after plantation a map of the life to which he was approaching. He saw the distant slaves at their toil. He saw afar their villages of huts, gleaming out in long rows on many a plantation, distant from the stately mansions and pleasure grounds of the master. And as the moving picture passed on, his poor foolish heart would be turning backward to the Kentucky farm, with its old shadowy beeches, to the master's house, with its wide cool halls, and nearby the little cabin overgrown with the multiflora and begonia. There he seemed to see familiar faces of comrades who had grown up with him from infancy. He saw his busy wife, bustling in her preparations for his evening meals. He heard the merry laugh of his boys at their play and the chirrup of the baby at his knee. And then with a start, all faded. And he saw again the cane brakes and cypresses and gliding plantations, and heard again the creaking and groaning of the machinery, all telling him too plainly that all that phase of life had gone by forever. In such a case you write to your wife and send messages to your children. But Tom could not write. The mail for him had no existence, and the gulf of separation was unabridged by even a friendly word or signal. It is strange, then, that some tears fall on the pages of his Bible as he lays it on the cotton bale, and with patient finger, threading his slow way from word to word, traces out its promises. Having learned late in life, Tom was but a slow reader and passed on laboriously from verse to verse. Fortunate for him was it that the book he was intent on was one which slow reading cannot injure, nay, one whose words, like ingots of gold, seemed often to need to be weighed separately. That the mind may take in their priceless value. Let us follow him a moment, as pointing to each word and pronouncing each half aloud, he reads, "Let not your heart be troubled. In my father's house are many mansions. I go to prepare a place for you.
Cicero, when he buried his darling and only daughter, had a heart as full of honest grief as poor Tom's. Perhaps no fuller, for both were only men. But Cicero could pause over no such sublime words of hope, and look to no such future reunion. And if he had seen them, 10 to 1 he would not have believed. He must fill his head first with 1,000 questions of authenticity, of manuscript, and correctness of translation. But to poor Tom, there it lay, just what he needed, so evidently true and divine, that the possibility of a question never entered his simple head. It must be true, for if it not true, how could he live?
As for Tom's Bible, though, it had no annotations and helps in margins from learned commentators. Still, it had been embellished with certain waymarks and guideboards of Tom's own invention, and which helped him more than the most learned expositions could have done. It had been his custom to get the Bible read to him by his master's children, in particular by young Master George, and as they read, he would designate, by bold, strong marks and dashes, with pen and ink, the passages which more particularly gratified his ear or affected his heart. His Bible was thus marked through, from one end to another, with a variety of styles and designations, so he could in a moment seize upon his favorite passages, without the labor of spelling out what lay between them. And while it lay there, before him, every passage breathing of some old home scene and recalling some past enjoyment, his Bible seemed to him all of this life that remained, as well as the promise of a future one. Among the passengers on the boat was a young gentleman of fortune and family, resident in New Orleans, who bore the name of St. Clair. He had with him a daughter, between 5 and 6 years of age, together with a lady who seemed to claim relationship to both, and to have the little one especially under her charge. Tom had often caught glimpses of this little girl, for she was one of those busy, tripping creatures that can be no more contained in one place than a sunbeam or a summer breeze. Nor was she one that, once seen, could be easily forgotten. Her form was the perfection of childish beauty, without its usual chubbiness and squareness of outline. There was about it an undulating and aerial grace, such as one might dream of for some mythic and allegorical being. Her face was remarkable, less for its perfect beauty of features than for a singular and dreamy earnestness of expression, which made her the ideal start when they looked at her, and by which the dullest and most literal were impressed, without exactly knowing why. The shape of her head and the turn of her neck and bust was peculiarly noble, and the long golden-brown hair that floated like a cloud around it, the deep spiritual gravity of her violet-blue eyes, shaded by heavy fringes of golden-brown, all marked her out from other children, and made everyone turn and look at her as she glided hither and thither on the boat. Nevertheless, the little one was not what you would have called either a grave child or a sad one. On the contrary, an airy and innocent playfulness seemed to flicker like the shadow of summer leaves over her childish face, and around her buoyant figure. She was always in motion, always with a half-smile on her rosy mouth, flying hither and thither, with an undulating and cloud-like tread, singing to herself as she moved, as in a happy dream. Her father and female guardian were incessantly busy in pursuit of her, but when caught, she melted from them again like a summer cloud, and as no word of chiding or reproof ever fell on her ear for whatever she chose to do, she pursued her own way all over the boat. Always dressed in white, she seemed to move like a shadow through all sorts of places, without contracting spot or stain, and there was not a corner or nook above or below where those fairy footsteps had not glided, and that visionary golden head, with its deep blue eyes, fleeted along. The fireman, as he looked up from his sweaty toil, sometimes found those eyes looking wonderingly into the raging depths of the furnace, and fearfully and pityingly at him, as if she thought him in some dreadful danger. Anon the steersman at the wheel paused and smiled, as the picture-like head gleamed through the window of the roundhouse, and in a moment was gone again. 1,000 times a day rough voices blessed her, and smiles of unwonted softness stole over hard faces as she passed. And when she tripped fearlessly over dangerous places, rough sooty hands were stretched involuntarily out to save her and smooth her path. Tom, who had the soft, impressible nature of his kindly race, ever yearning toward the simple and childlike, watched the little creature with daily increasing interest. To him she seemed something almost divine, and whenever her golden head and deep blue eyes peered out upon him from behind some dusky cotton bale, or looked down upon him over some ridge of packages, he half believed that he saw one of the angels stepped out of his New Testament. Often and often she walked mournfully round the place where Haley's gang of men and women sat in their chains. She would glide in among them and look at them with an air of perplexed and sorrowful earnestness, and sometimes she would lift their chains with her slender hands and then sigh woefully as she glided away. Several times she appeared suddenly among them, with her hands full of candy, nuts, and oranges, which she would distribute joyfully to them and then be gone again. Tom watched the little lady a great deal before he ventured on any overtures towards acquaintanceship.
He knew an abundance of simple acts to propitiate and invite the approaches of the little people, and he resolved to play